This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Warded Man by Peter V. Brett, narrated by Pete Bradbury and directed by Dave Millen.
Section 1. Tibbetts Brook, 318-319 AR, after return. Chapter 1. Aftermath, 319 AR. The great horn sounded. Arlen paused in his work, looking up at the lavender wash of the dawn sky. Mist still clung to the air, bringing with it a damp, acrid taste that was all too familiar. A quiet dread built in his gut as he waited in the morning stillness, hoping that it had been his imagination. He was 11 years old. There was a pause, and then the horn blew twice in rapid succession. One long and two short meant south and east, the cluster by the woods. His father had friends among the cutters. Behind Arlen, the door to the house opened, and he knew his mother would be there, covering her mouth with both hands. Arlen returned to his work, not needing to be told to hurry. Some chores could wait a day, but the stock still needed to be fed and the cows milked. He left the animals in the barns and opened the hay stores, slopped the pigs, and ran to fetch a wooden milk bucket. His mother was already squatting beneath the first of the cows. He snatched the spare stool and they found cadence in their work, the sound of milk striking wood drumming a funeral march. As they moved to the next pair down the line, Arlen saw his father begin hitching their strongest horse, a 5-year-old chestnut-colored mare named Missy, to the cart. His face was grim as he worked. What would they find this time? Before long, they were in the cart, trundling toward the small cluster of houses by the woods. It was dangerous there, over an hour's run to the nearest warded structure, but the lumber was needed. Arlen's mother, wrapped in her worn shawl, held him tightly as they rode. "I'm a big boy, ma'am," Arlen complained. "I don't need you to hold me like a baby. I'm not scared." It wasn't entirely true, but it wouldn't do for the other children to see him clinging to his mother as they rode in. They made mock of him enough as it was. "I'm scared," the mother said. "What if it's me who needs to be held?" Feeling suddenly proud, Arlen pulled close to his mother again as they traveled down the road. She could never fool him, but she always knew what to say just the same. A pillar of greasy smoke told them more than they wanted to know long before they reached their destination. They were burning the dead, and starting the fires this early without waiting for others to arrive and pray meant there were a great many. Too many to pray over each one, if the work was to be complete before dusk. It was more than 5 miles from Arlen's father's farm to the cluster by the woods. By the time they arrived, the few remaining cabin fires had been put out, though in truth there was little left to burn. 15 houses, all reduced to rubble and ash. "The woodpiles, too," Arlen's father said, spitting over the side of the cart. He gestured with his chin toward the blackened ruin that remained of a season's cutting. Arlen grimaced at the thought of how the rickety fence that pinned the animals would have to last another year, and immediately felt guilty. It was only wood, after all. The townspeaker approached their cart as it pulled up. Celia, whom Arlen's mother sometimes called Celia the Baron, was a hard woman, tall and thin, with skin like tough leather. Her long gray hair was pulled into a tight bun, and she wore her shawl like a badge of office. She brooked no nonsense, as Arlen had learned more than once at the end of her stick, but today he was comforted by her presence. Like Arlen's father, something about Celia made him feel safe. Though she had never had children of her own, Celia acted as a parent to everyone in Tibbetts Brook. Few could match her wisdom, and fewer still her stubbornness. When you were on Celia's good side, it felt like the safest place in the world. It's good that you've come, Jeff, Celia told Arlen's father. Sylvie and young Arlen, too, she said, nodding to them. We need every hand we can get. Even the boy can help. Arlen's father grunted, stepping down from the cart. I brought my tools, he said. Just tell me where we can throw in. Arlen collected the precious tools from the back of the cart. Metal was scarce in the brook, and his father was proud of his two shovels, his pick, and his saw. They would all see heavy use this day. How many lost? Jeff asked, though he didn't really seem to want to know. 27, Celia said. Sylvie choked and covered her mouth, tears welling in her eyes. Jeff spat again. Many survivors? He asked. A few, Celia said. Manny, she pointed with her stick at a boy who stood staring at the funeral pyre, ran all the way to my house in the dark. Sylvie gasped. No one had ever run so far and lived. The wards on Brian Cutter's house held for most of the night, Celia went on. He and his family watched everything. A few others fled the Corlings and suckered there until the fires spread and their roof caught. They waited in the burning house until the beams started to crack and then took their chances outside in the minutes before dawn. The Corlings killed Brian's wife Mina and their son Poole, but the others made it. The burns will heal and the children will be all right in time, but the others... She didn't need to finish the sentence. Survivors of a demon attack had a way of dying soon after. Not all, or even most, but enough. Some of them took their own lives, and others simply stared blankly, refusing to eat or drink until they wasted away. It was said you didn't truly survive an attack until a year and a day had passed. There are still a dozen unaccounted for, Celia said, but with little hope in her voice. We'll dig 'em out, Jeff agreed grimly, looking at the collapsed houses, many still smoldering. The Cutters built their homes mostly out of stone to protect against fire, but even stone would burn if the wards failed and enough flame demons gathered in one place. Jeff joined the other men and a few of the stronger women in clearing the rubble and carting the dead to the pyre. The bodies had to be burned, of course. No one would want to be buried in the same ground the demons rose out of each night. Tender Harrel, the sleeves of his robe rolled up to bare his thick arms, lifted each into the fire himself, muttering prayers and drawing wards in the air as the flames took them. Sylvie joined the other women in gathering the younger children and tending to the wounded under the watchful eye of the brook's herb-gatherer, Colleen Trigg. But no herbs could ease the pain of the survivors. Brian Cutter, also called Brian Broadshoulders, was a great bear of a man with a booming laugh who used to throw Arlen into the air when they came to trade for wood. Now Brian sat in the ashes beside his ruined house, slowly knocking his head against the blackened wall. He muttered to himself and clutched his arms tightly, as if cold. Arlen and the other children were put to work carrying water and sorting through the wood piles for salvageable lumber. There were still a few warm months left of the year, but there wouldn't be time to cut enough wood to last the winter. They'd be burning dung again this year, and the house would reek. Again, Arlen weathered a wave of guilt. He wasn't in the pyre, nor banging his head in shock, having lost everything. There were worse fates than a house smelling of dung. More and more villagers arrived as the morning wore on. Bringing their families and whatever provisions they could spare, they came from Fishing Hole and Town Square. They came from Boggins Hill and Soggy Marsh. Some even came all the way from Southwatch. And one by one, Celia greeted them with the grim news and put them to work. With more than 100 hands, the men doubled their efforts, half of them continuing to dig as the others descended upon the only salvageable structure left in the cluster, Brian Cutter's house. Celia led Brian away, somehow supporting the giant man as he stumbled, while the men cleared the rubble and began hauling new stones. A few took out warding kits and began to paint fresh wards while children made thatch. The house would be restored by nightfall. Arlen was partnered with Kobe Fisher in hauling wood. The children had amassed a sizable pile, though it was only a fraction of what had been lost. Kobe was a tall, thickly built boy with dark curls and hairy arms. He was popular among the other children, but it was popularity built at others' expense. Few children cared to weather his insults, and fewer still his beatings. Kobe had tortured Arlen for years, and the other children had gone along. Jeff's farm was the northernmost in the brook, far from where the children tended to gather in town square, and Arlen spent most of his free time wandering the brook by himself. Sacrificing him to Kobe's wrath seemed a fair trade to most children. Whenever Arlen went fishing or passed by Fishing Hole on the way to town square, Kobe and his friends seemed to hear about it and were waiting in the same spot on his way home. Sometimes they just called him names or pushed him, but other times he came home bloody and bruised, and his mother shouted at him for fighting. Finally, Arlen had enough. They left a stout stick hidden in that spot, and the next time Kobe and his friends pounced, Arlen pretended to run, only to produce the weapon as if from thin air and come back swinging. Kobe was the first one struck, a hard blow that left him crying in the dirt with blood running from his ear. Willem received a broken finger, and Gart walked with a limp for over a week. It had done nothing to improve Arlen's popularity among the other children, and Arlen's father had caned him, but the other boys never bothered him again. Even now, Kobe gave him a wide berth and flinched if Arlen made a sudden move, even though he was bigger by far. "Survivors!" Bill Baker called suddenly, standing by a collapsed house at the edge of the cluster. "I can hear them trapped in the root cellar." Immediately, everyone dropped what they were doing and rushed over. Clearing the rubble would take too long, so the men began to dig, bending their backs with silent fervor. Soon after, they broke through the side of the cellar and began hauling out the survivors. They were filthy and terrified, but all were very much alive. 3 women, 6 children, and 1 man. "Uncle Charlie!" Arlen cried, and his mother was there in an instant, cradling her brother, who stumbled drunkenly. Arlen ran to them, ducking under his other arm to steady him. "Charlie, what are you doing here?" Sylvie asked. Charlie seldom left his workshop in town square. Arlen's mother had told the tale 1,000 times of how she and her brother had run the farrier's shop together before Jeff began breaking his horse's shoes on purpose for a reason to come court. "Came to court Anna Cutter," Charlie mumbled. He pulled at his hair, having already torn whole clumps free. "We just opened the boat hole when they came through the wards." His knees buckled, pulling Arlen and Sylvie down with his weight. Kneeling in the dirt, he wept. Arlen looked at the other survivors. Anna Cutter wasn't among them. His throat tightened as the children passed. He knew every one of them, their families, what their houses were like inside and out, their animals' names. They met his eyes for a second as they went by, and in that moment he lived the attack through their eyes. He saw himself shoved into a cramped hole in the ground, while those unable to fit turned to face the corlings and the fire. Suddenly he started gasping, unable to stop until Jeff slapped him on the back and brought him to his senses. They were finishing a cold midday meal when a horn sounded on the far side of the brook. "Not 2 in 1 day," Sylvie gasped, covering her mouth. "Bah," Celia grunted. "At midday? Use your head, girl."
"Then what?"
Celia ignored her, rising to fetch a horn blower to signal back. Kevin Marsh had his horn ready, as the folks from Soggy Marsh always did. It was easy to get separated in the marshes, and no one wanted to be wandering lost when the swamp demons rose. Kevin's cheeks inflated like a frog's chin as he blew a series of notes. "Messenger horn," Corin Marsh advised Sylvie. A graybeard, he was speaker for Soggy Marsh and Kevin's father. "They probably saw the smoke. Kevin's telling them what's happened and where everyone is."
"A messenger in spring?" Arlen asked.
I thought they'd come in the fall after harvest. We only finished planting this past moon.
Messenger never came last fall, Corrin said, spitting foamy brown juice from the root he was chewing through the gap of his missing teeth. We've been worried something happened. Thought we might not have a messenger bring salt till next fall. Or maybe that the Corlings got the free cities and we's cut off.
The Corlings could never get the free cities, Arlen said. Arlen, shush your mouth, Sylvie hissed. He's your elder.
Let the boy speak, Corrin said. Ever been to a free city, boy? He asked Arlen.
No, Arlen admitted.
Ever know anyone who had?
No, Arlen said again.
So what makes you such an expert? Corrin asked. Ain't no one been to one except the messengers. They're the only ones would brave the night to go so far. Who's to say the free cities ain't just places like the brook? If the Corlings can get us, they can get them too.
Old Hogg is from the free cities, Arlen said. Roscoe Hogg was the richest man in the brook. He ran the general store, which was the crux of all commerce in Tibbetsbrook.
Aye, Corrin said. And old Hogg told me years ago that one trip was enough for him. He meant to go back after a few years, but said it wasn't worth the risk. So you ask him if the free cities are any safer than anywhere else.
Arlen didn't want to believe it. There had to be safe places in the world. But again the image of himself being thrown into the cellar flashed across his mind, and he knew that nowhere was truly safe at night. The messenger arrived an hour later. He was a tall man in his early 30s, with cropped brown hair and a short, thick beard. Draped about his broad shoulders was a shirt of metal links, and he wore a long, dark cloak with thick leather breeches and boots. His mare was a sleek brown courser. Strapped to the horse's saddle was a harness holding a number of different spears. His face was grim as he approached, but his shoulders were high and proud. He scanned the crowd and spotted the speaker easily as she stood giving orders. He turned his horse toward her. Riding a few paces behind on a heavily laden cart pulled by a pair of dark brown mollies was the jongleur. His clothes were a brightly colored patchwork, and he had a lute resting on the bench next to him. His hair was a color Arlen had never seen before, like a pale carrot. And his skin was so fair it seemed the sun had never touched it. His shoulders slumped, and he looked thoroughly exhausted. There was always a jongleur with the annual messenger. To the children, and some of the adults, the jongleur was the more important of the two. For as long as Arlen could remember, it had been the same man, gray-haired but spry and full of cheer. His new one was younger, and he seemed sullen. Children ran to him immediately, and the young jongleur perked up. The frustration melting from his face so quickly, Arlen began to doubt it was ever there. In an instant, the jongleur was off the cart and spinning his colored balls into the air as the children cheered. Others, Arlen among them, forgot their work, drifting toward the newcomers. Celia whirled on them, having none of it. "The day is no longer because the messengers come," she barked. "Back to your work!" There were grumbles, but everyone went back to work. "Not you, Arlen," Celia said. "Come here." Arlen pulled his eyes from the jongleur and went to her as the messenger arrived. "Celia Baron," the messenger asked. "Just Celia will do," Celia replied primly. The messenger's eyes widened and he blushed, the tops of his pale cheeks turning a deep red above his beard. He leapt down from his horse and bowed low. "Apologies," he said. "I didn't think. Greg, your usual messenger, told me that's what you were called." "It's pleasing to know what Greg thinks of me after all these years," Celia said, sounding not at all pleased. "Thought," the messenger corrected.
"He's dead, ma'am."
"Dead?" Celia asked, looking suddenly sad. "Was it?"
The messenger shook his head. "It was a chill took him, not Corlings.
I'm Reagan, your messenger this year, as a favor to his widow. The Guild will select a new messenger for you starting next fall.
A year and a half again before the next messenger? Celia asked, sounding like she was readying a scolding. We barely made it through this past winter without the fall salt, she said. I know you take it for granted in Milne, but half our meat and fish spoil for lack of proper curing. And what of our letters?
Sorry, ma'am, Reagan said. Your towns are well off the common roads, and paying a messenger to commit for a month and more of travel each year is costly. The Messenger's Guild is short-handed, what with Greg catching that chill. He chuckled and shook his head, but noticed Celia's visage darken in response. No offense meant, ma'am, Reagan said. He was my friend as well. It's just... it's not many of us messengers get to go with a roof above, a bed below, and a young wife at our side. The night usually gets us before that, you see? I do, Celia said. Do you have a wife, Reagan? She asked. Aye, the messenger said. Though to hurt pleasure in my pain, I see my mare more than my bride. He laughed, confusing Arlen, who didn't think having a wife not miss you was funny. Celia didn't seem to notice. What if you couldn't see her at all? She asked. What if all you had were letters once a year to connect you to her? How would you feel to hear your letters would be delayed half a year? There are some in this town with kin in the free cities. Left with one messenger or another, some as much as two generations gone. Those people ain't going to come home, Reagan. Letters are all we have of them, and they of us. I'm in full agreement with you, ma'am, Reagan said. But the decision isn't mine to make. The Duke... But you will speak to the Duke upon your return, yes? Celia asked. I will, he said. Shall I write the message down for you? Celia asked. Reagan smiled. I think I can remember it, ma'am. See that you do. Reagan bowed again, still lower. Apologies for coming to call on such a dark day, he said, his eyes flicking to the funeral pyre. We can't tell the rain when to come, nor the wind, nor the cold, Celia said. Not the Corlings, either. So life must go on despite these things. Life goes on, Reagan agreed. But if there's anything I or my jongleur can do to help, I've a strong back, and I've treated Corling wounds many times. Your jongleur is helping already, Celia said, nodding toward the young man as he sang and did his tricks. Distracting the young ones while their kin do their work. As for you, I've much to do over the next few days if we're to recover from this loss. I won't have time to hand the mail and read to those who haven't learned their letters. I could read to those who can't, ma'am, Reagan said. But I don't know your town well enough to distribute. No need, Celia said, pulling Arlen forward. Arlen here will take you to the general store in Town Square. Give the letters and packages to Rusko Hogg when you deliver the salt. Most everyone will come running now that the salt's in, and Rusko's one of the few in town with letters and numbers. The old crook will complain and try to insist on payment, but you tell him that in time of trouble the whole town must throw in. You tell him to give out the letters and read to those who can't, or I'll not lift a finger the next time the town wants to throw a rope around his neck. Reagan looked closely at Celia, perhaps trying to tell if she was joking, but her stony face gave no indication. He bowed again. Hurry along, then, Celia said. Lift your feet, and you'll both be back as everyone is readying to leave here for the night. If you and your jongleur don't want to pay Rusko for a room, any here will be glad to offer their homes. She shooed the two of them away, and turned back to scold those pausing their work to stare at the newcomers. Is she always so forceful? Reagan asked Arlen as they walked over to where the jongleur was mumming for the youngest children. The rest had been pulled back to work. Arlen snorted. You should hear her talk to the Greybeards. You're lucky to get away with your skin after calling her Baron. Greg said that's what everyone called her, Reagan said. They do, Arlen agreed. Just not to her face, unless they're looking to take a coiling by the horns. Everyone hops when Celia speaks. Reagan chuckled. And her an old daughter at that, he mused. Where I come from, only mothers expect everyone to jump at their command like that. What difference does that make? Arlen asked. Reagan shrugged. Don't know, I suppose, he conceded. That's just how things are in Milne. People make the world go, and mothers make people, so they lead the dance. It's not like that here, Arlen said. It never is in the small towns, Reagan said. Not enough people to spare, but the free cities are different. Apart from Milne, none of the others give their women much voice at all. That sounds just as dumb, Arlen muttered. It is, Reagan agreed. The messenger stopped and handed Arlen the reins to his courser. Wait here a minute, he said, and headed over to the jongleur. The two men moved aside to talk, and Arlen saw the jongleur's face change again, becoming angry, then petulant, and finally resigned as he tried to argue with Reagan, whose face remained stony throughout. Never taking his glare off the jongleur, the messenger beckoned with a hand to Arlen, who brought the horse over to them. "Don't care how tired you are," Reagan was saying, his voice a harsh whisper. "These people have grisly work to do, and if you need to dance and juggle all afternoon to keep their kids occupied while they do it, then you'd damn well better. Now put your face back on and get to it." He grabbed the reins from Arlen and thrust them at the man. Arlen got a good look at the young jongleur's face, full of indignation and fear, before the jongleur took notice of him. The second he saw he was being watched, the man's face rippled, and a moment later he was the bright, cheerful fellow who danced for children. Reagan took Arlen to the cart, and the two climbed on. Reagan snapped the reins, and they turned back up the dirt path that led to the main road. "What were you arguing about?" Arlen asked as the cart bounced along. The messenger looked at him a moment, then shrugged. "It's Kieran's first time so far out of the city," he said. "He was brave enough when there was a group of us and he had a covered wagon to sleep in, but when we left the rest of our caravan behind in Angiers, he didn't do near as well. He's got day jitters from the corlings, and it's made him poor company." "I can't tell," Arlen said, looking back at the cartwheeling man. "Jongleurs have their mummers' tricks," Reagan said. "They can pretend so hard to be something they're not that they actually convince themselves of it for a time. Kieran pretended to be brave. The guild tested him for travel, and he passed, but you never really know how people will hold up after 2 weeks on the open road until they do it for real." "How do you stay out on the roads at night?" Arlen asked. "Da says drawing wards in the dirt's asking for trouble." "Your Da is right," Reagan said. "Look in that compartment by your feet." Arlen did, and produced a large bag of soft leather. Inside was a knotted rope strung with lacquered wooden plates bigger than his hand. His eyes widened when he saw wards carved and painted into the wood. Immediately, Arlen knew what it was. A portable warding circle, large enough to surround the cart and more besides. "I've never seen anything like it," Arlen said. "They're not easy to make," the messenger said. "Most messengers spend their whole apprenticeship mastering the art. No wind or rain is going to smudge those wards. But even then, they're not the same as having warded walls and a door." "Never see a corling face to face, boy?" he asked, turning and looking at Arlen hard. "Watched it take a swipe at you with nowhere to run and nothing to protect you except magic you can't see?" He shook his head. "Maybe I'm being too hard on Kieran. He handled his test all right. Screamed a bit, but that's to be expected. Night after night is another matter. It takes its toll on some men. Always worried that a stray leaf will land on a ward, and then—" He hissed suddenly and swiped a clawed hand at Arlen, laughing when the boy jumped. Arlen ran his thumb over each smooth, lacquered ward, feeling their strength. There was one of the little plates for every foot of rope, much as there would be in any warding. He counted more than 40 of them. "Can't wind demons fly into a circle this big?" he asked. "Da puts posts up to keep them from landing in the fields." The man looked over at him, a little surprised. "Your Da's probably wasting his time," he said. "Wind demons are strong flyers, but they need running space or something to climb and leap from in order to take off. Not much of either in a cornfield, so they'd be reluctant to land, unless they saw something too tempting to resist, like some little boy sleeping in the field on a dare." He looked at Arlen in the same way that Jeff did, when warning Arlen that the Corlings were serious business, as if he didn't know. "Wind demons also need to turn in wide arcs," Reagan continued, "and most of them have a wingspan larger than that circle. It's possible that one could get in, but I've never seen it happen. If it does, though..." He gestured to the long, thick spear he kept next to him. "You can kill a Corling with a spear?" Arlen asked. "Probably not," Reagan replied, "but I've heard that you can stun them by pinning them against your wards." He chuckled. "I hope I never have to find out." Arlen looked at him wide-eyed. Reagan looked back at him, his face suddenly serious. "Messaging's dangerous work, boy," he said. Arlen stared at him a long time. "It would be worth it to see the free cities," he said at last. "Tell me true, what's Fort Milne like?" "It's the richest and most beautiful city in the world," Reagan replied, lifting his mail sleeve to reveal a tattoo on his forearm of a city nestled between two mountains. "The Duke's mines run rich with salt, metal, and coal. Its walls and rooftops are so well warded it's rare for the house wards to even be tested. When the sun shines on its walls, it puts the mountains themselves to shame." "I've never seen a mountain," Arlen said, marveling as he traced the tattoo with a finger. "My Da says they're just big hills." "You see that hill?" Reagan asked, pointing north of the road. Arlen nodded. "Boggins Hill. You can see the whole brook from up there." Reagan nodded. "You know what 100 means, Arlen?" he asked. Arlen nodded again. 10 pairs of hands."
"Well, even a small mountain is bigger than 100 of your Boggins Hills piled atop each other, and the mountains of Milne aren't small."
Arlen's eyes widened as he tried to contemplate such a height.
"They must touch the sky," he said.
"Some are above it," Reagan bragged. "Atop them you can look down at the clouds."
"I want to see that one day," Arlen said.
"You could join the Messengers Guild when you're old enough," Reagan said. Arlen shook his head.
"Da says that people that leave are deserters," he said. "He spits when he says it."
"Your Da doesn't know what he's talking about," Reagan said. "Spitting doesn't make things so. Without messengers, even the free cities would crumble."
"I thought the free cities were safe," Arlen asked.
"Nowhere is safe, Arlen. Not truly. Milne has more people and can absorb the deaths more easily than a place like Tibbetts Brook, but the Corlings still take a toll each year."
"How many people are in Milne?" Arlen asked.
"We have 900s in Tibbetts Brook, and Sunny Pasture up the ways is supposed to be almost as big." "We have over 30,000 in Milne," Reagan said proudly. Arlen looked at him confused. 1,000 is 1,000s, the messenger supplied. Arlen thought a moment, then shook his head.
"There aren't that many people in the world," he said.
"There are, and more," Reagan said. "There's a wide world out there for those willing to brave the dark." Arlen didn't answer, and they rode in silence for a time.
It took about an hour and a half for the trundling cart to reach Town Square. The center of the brook, Town Square held a few dozen warded wooden houses for those whose trade didn't have them working in the fields or rice paddies, fishing or cutting wood. It was here one came to find the tailor and the baker, the farrier, the cooper, and the rest. At the center lay the square where people would gather, and the biggest building in the brook, the general store. It had a large open front room that housed tables and the bar, and an even larger storeroom in the back, and a cellar below, filled with most everything of value in the brook. The kitchen was run by Hogg's daughters, Daisy and Katrin. 2 credits could buy a meal to leave you stuffed, but Sylvie called old Hogg a cheat, since 2 credits could buy enough raw grain for a week. Still, plenty of unmarried men paid the price, and not all for the food. Daisy was homely, and Katrin fat, but Uncle Charlie said the men who married them would be set for life. Everyone in the brook brought Hogg their goods, be it corn, or meat, or fur, pottery or cloth, furniture or tools. Hogg took the items, counted them up, and gave the customers credits to buy other things at the store. Things always seemed to cost a lot more than Hogg paid for them, though. Arla knew enough numbers to see that. There were some famous arguments when people came to sell, but Hogg set the prices and usually got his way. Just about everyone hated Hogg, but they needed him all the same, and were more likely to brush his coat and open his doors than spit when he passed. Everyone else in the brook worked throughout the sun and barely saw all their needs met, but Hogg and his daughters always had fleshy cheeks, rounded bellies, and clean new clothes. Arlen had to wrap himself in a rug whenever his mother took his overalls to wash. Reagan and Arlen tied off the mules in front of the store and went inside. The bar was empty. Usually the air inside the tap room was thick with bacon fat, but there was no smell of cooking from the kitchen today. Arlen rushed ahead of the messenger to the bar. Rusko had a small bronze bell there, brought with him when he came from the Free Cities. Arlen loved that bell. He slapped his hand down on it and grinned at the clear sound. There was a thump in the back, and Rusko came through the curtains behind the bar. He was a big man, still strong and straight-backed at 60, but a soft gut hung around his middle, and his iron-gray hair was creeping back from his lined forehead. He wore light trousers and leather shoes with a clean white cotton shirt. The sleeves rolled halfway up his thick forearms. His white apron was spotless, as always. "Arlen Bales," he said with a patient smile, seeing the boy. "Did you come just to play with the bell, or do you have some business?" "The business is mine," Reagan said, stepping forward. "You Rusko Hogg?" "Just Rusko will do," the man said. "The townie slapped the Hogg on, though not to my face. Can't stand to see a man prosper."
"That's twice," Reagan mused.
"Say again," Rusko said.
"Twice that Greg's journey log has led me astray," Reagan said. "I called Celia Barron to her face this morning."
Rusko laughed. "Did you now? Well, that's worth a drink on the house if anything is. What'd you say your name was?"
"Reagan," the messenger said, dropping his heavy satchel and taking a seat at the bar. Rusko tapped a keg and plucked a slatted wooden mug off a hook. The ale was thick and honey-colored and foamed to a white head atop the mug. Rusko filled one for Reagan and another for himself. Then he glanced at Arlen and filled a smaller cup.
"Take that to a table and let your elders talk at the bar," he said. "And if you know what's good for you, you won't tell your mama gave it to you."
Arlen beamed and ran off with his prize before Rusko had a chance to reconsider. He'd snuck a taste of ale from his father's mug at festivals, but had never had a cup of his own.
"I was starting to worry no one was coming ever again," he heard Rusko tell Reagan.
"Greg took a chill just before he was to leave last fall," Reagan said, drinking deeply. "His herb gatherer told him to put the trip off until he got better, but then winter set in and he got worse and worse. In the end, he asked me to take his route until the guild could find another.
I had to take a caravan of salt to Angiers anyway, so I added an extra cart and swung this way before heading back north. Rusko took his mug and filled it again. "To Greg," he said. "A fine messenger and a dangerous haggler." Reagan nodded, and the two men clapped mugs and drank. "Another?" Rusko asked when Reagan slammed his mug back down on the bar. "Greg wrote in his log that you were a dangerous haggler, too," Reagan said, "and that you'd try to get me drunk first." Rusko chuckled and refilled the mug. "After the haggling, I'll have no need to serve these on the house," he said, handing it to Reagan with a fresh head. "You will if you want your mail to reach Milne," Reagan said with a grin, accepting the mug. "I can see you're going to be as tough as Greg ever was," Rusko grumbled, filling his own mug. "There," he said when it foamed over. "We can both haggle drunk." They laughed and clashed mugs again. "What news of the Free Cities?" Rusko asked. "The Krasians still determined to destroy themselves?" Reagan shrugged. "By all accounts, I stopped going to Krasia a few years ago when I married. Too far and too dangerous. So the fact that they cover their women in blankets has nothing to do with it?" Rusko asked. Reagan laughed. "It doesn't help," he said. "But it's mostly how they think all northerners, even messengers, are cowards for not spending our nights trying to get ourselves cored." "Maybe they'd be less inclined to fight if they looked at their women more," Rusko mused. "How about Angiers and Milne? The Duke's still bickering?" "As always," Reagan said. "Euchre needs Angiers wood to fuel his refineries and grain to feed his people. Rhinebeck needs Milne's metal and salt. They have to trade to survive, but instead of making it easy on themselves, they spend all their time trying to cheat each other, especially when a shipment is lost to Corlings on the road. Last summer, demons hit a caravan of steel and salt. They killed the drivers, but left most of the cargo intact. Rhinebeck retrieved it and refused to pay, claiming salvage rights." "Duke Euchre must have been furious," Rusko said. "Livid," Reagan agreed. "I was the one that brought in the news. He went red in the face and swore Angiers wouldn't see another ounce of salt until Rhinebeck paid." "Did Rhinebeck pay?" Rusko asked, leaning in eagerly. Reagan shook his head. "They did their best to starve each other for a few months, and then the Merchants Guild paid just to get their shipments out before the winter came, and they rotted in storage. Rhinebeck is angry at them now for giving in to Euchre, but his face was saved and the shipments were moving again, which is all that mattered to anyone other than those two dogs." "Wise to watch what you call the Dukes," Rusko warned, "even this far out." "Who's going to tell them?" Reagan asked. "You? The boy?" He gestured at Arlen. Both men laughed. "And now I have to bring Euchre news of Riverbridge, which will make things worse," Reagan said. "The town on the border of Milne," Rusko said. "Barely a day out from Angiers. I have contacts there." "Not anymore, you don't," Reagan said pointedly, and the men were quiet for a time. "Enough bad news," Reagan said, hauling his satchel onto the bar. Rusko considered it dubiously. "That doesn't look like salt," he said. "I don't have that much mail." "You have 6 letters and an even dozen packages," Reagan said, handing Rusko a sheaf of folded paper. "It's all listed here, along with all the other letters in the satchel and packages in the cart to be distributed. I gave Celia a copy of the list," he warned. "What do I want with that list or your mailbag?" Rusko asked. "The speaker is occupied and won't be able to distribute the mail and read to those that can't. She volunteered you." "And how am I to be compensated for spending my business hours reading to the townies?" Rusko asked. "The satisfaction of a good deed to your neighbors?" Reagan asked. Rusko snorted. "I didn't come to Tibbetsbrook to make friends," he said. "I'm a businessman, and I do a lot for this town." "Do you?" Reagan asked. "Damn right," Rusko said. "Before I came to this town, all they did was barter.
He made the word a curse and spat on the floor.
They collected the fruits of their labor and gathered in the square every seventh day, arguing over how many beans were worth an ear of corn, or how much rice you had to give the cooper to make you a barrel to put your rice in. And if you didn't get what you needed on seventh day, you had to wait until the next week, or go door to door. Now everyone can come here any day, any time, from sunup to sundown, and trade for credits to get whatever else they need.
The town savior, Reagan said wryly. And you asking nothing in return?
Nothing but a tidy profit, Musco said with a grin.
And how often do the villagers try to string you up for a cheat? Reagan asked.
Musco's eyes narrowed.
Too often, considering half of them can't count past their fingers and the other half can only add their toes to that, he said.
Celia said the next time it happens you're on your own. Reagan's friendly voice had suddenly gone hard. Unless you do your part. There's plenty on the far side of town suffering worse than having to read the mail.
Musco frowned, but he took the list and carried the heavy bag into his storeroom.
How bad is it, really?
He asked when he returned. Bad, Reagan said.
27 so far, and a few still unaccounted for.
Creator, Musco swore, drawing a ward in the air in front of him. I thought a family, at worst.
If only, Reagan said.
They were both silent for a moment, as was decent, then looked up at each other as one.
You have this year's salt? Musco asked.
You have the Duke's rice? Reagan replied. Been holding it all winter, you being so late, Musco said.
Reagan's eyes narrowed.
Oh, it's still good,
Rusko said, his hands coming up suddenly, as if pleading. I've kept it sealed and dry, and there are no vermin in my cellar.
I'll need to be sure, you understand, Reagan said.
Of course, Rusko said. Arlen, fetch that lamp, he ordered, pointing the boy toward the corner of the bar.
Arlen scurried over to the lantern, picking up the striker. He lit the wick and lowered the glass reverently. He had never been trusted to hold glass before. It was colder than he imagined, but quickly grew warm as the flame licked it.
"Carry it down to the cellar for us," Rusko ordered.
Arlen tried to contain his excitement. He'd always wanted to see behind the bar. They said if everyone in the brook put all their possessions in one pile, it wouldn't rival the wonders of Hog's Cellar. He watched as Rusko pulled a ring on his floor, opening a wide trap. Arlen came forward quickly, worried old Hog would change his mind. He went down the creaking steps, holding the lantern high to illuminate the way. As he did, the light touched on stacks of crates and barrels from floor to ceiling, running in even rows, stretching back past the edges of the light. The floor was wooden to prevent corlings from rising directly into the cellar from the core, but there were still wards carved into the racks along the walls. Old Hog was careful with his treasures. The storekeeper led the way through the aisles to the sealed barrels in the back.
They look unspoiled, Reagan said, inspecting the wood. He considered a moment, then chose at random.
That one, he said, pointing to a barrel.
Rusko grunted and hauled out the barrel in question.
Some people called his work easy, but his arms were as hard and thick as any that swung an axe or scythe. He broke the seal and popped the top off the barrel, scooping rice into a shallow pan for Reagan to inspect.
"Good marsh rice," he told the messenger. "And not a weevil to be seen, nor sign of rot. This will fetch a high price in mill, especially after so long."
Reagan grunted and nodded, so the cask was resealed and they returned upstairs. They argued for some time over how many barrels of rice the heavy sacks of salt or the cart were worth. In the end, neither of them seemed happy, but they shook hands on the deal. Rusko called his daughters, and they all went up to the cart to begin unloading the salt. Arlen tried lifting a bag, but it was far too heavy, and he staggered and fell, dropping it.
"Be careful," Daisy scolded, slapping the back of his head. "If you can't lift, then get the door," Caitrin barked. She herself had one sack over her shoulder and another tucked under her meaty arm. Arlen scrambled to his feet and rushed to hold the portal for her.
"Fetch Ferd Miller and tell him we'll pay five... make it 4 credits for every sack he grinds," Rusko told Arlen.
Most everyone in the brook worked for Hogg, one way or another, but the square folk most of all.
5 if he packs it in barrels with rice to keep it dry.
"Ferd is off in the cluster," Arlen said. "Most everyone is." Rusko grunted but didn't reply. Soon enough the cart was empty, save for a few boxes and sacks that didn't contain salt. Rusko's daughters eyed those hungrily, but said nothing.
"We'll carry the rice up from the cellar tonight and keep it in the back room until you're ready to head back to Milne," Rusko said, when the last sack was hauled inside.
"Thank you," Regan said.
"The Duke's business is done, then,"
Rusko asked with a grin, his eyes flicking knowingly to the remaining items in the cart.
"The Duke's business, yes," Regan said, grinning in return.
Arlen hoped they would give him another ale while they haggled. It made him feel light-headed, like he'd caught a chill, but without the coughing and sneezing and aches. He liked the feeling and wanted to try it again. He helped carry the remaining items into the tap room, and Catrin brought out a platter of sandwiches thick with meat. Arlen was given a second cup of ale to wash it down, and old Hogg told him he could have 2 credits in the book for his work.
"I won't tell your parents," Hogg said, "but if you spend it on ale and they catch you, you'll be working off the grief your mum gives me."
Arlen nodded eagerly. He never had credits of his own to spend at the store. After lunch, Rusko and Regan went over to the bar and opened up the other items the messenger had brought. Arlen's eyes flared as each treasure was presented. They were bolts of cloth, finer than anything he had ever seen. Metal tools and pins, ceramics and exotic spices. There were even a few cups made of bright, sparkling glass. Hogg seemed less impressed.
"Greg had a better haul last year," he said. "I'll give you 100 credits for the lot."
Marlin's jaw dropped. 100 credits? Regan could own half the brook for that. Regan didn't care for the offer, though. His eyes went hard again, and he slammed his hand down on the table. Daisy and Catrin looked up from their cleaning at the sound.
"To the core with your credit," he growled. "I'm not one of your bumpkins, and unless you want the guild to know you for a cheat, you'll not mistake me for one again."
"No hard feelings,"
Rusko laughed, patting the air in that placating way he had.
"I had to try, you understand. They still like gold up there in Milne?" he asked with a sly smile.
"Same as everywhere," Regan said. He was still frowning, but the anger had drained from his voice.
"Not out here," Rusko said.
He went back behind the curtain, and they could hear him rummaging around, raising his voice to still be heard.
"Out here, if you can't eat something or wear it, paint a ward with it, or use it to till your field, it's not worth much of anything."
He returned a moment later with a large cloth sack he deposited on the counter with a clink.
"People here have forgotten that gold moves the world," he went on, reaching into the bag and pulling out 2 heavy yellow coins, which he waved in Reagan's face. "The miller's kids were using these as game pieces." "Game pieces. I told them I'd trade the gold for a carved wood game set I had in the back. They thought I was doing them a favor. Third even came by the next day to thank me."
He laughed a deep belly laugh. Arlen felt like he should be offended by that laugh, but he wasn't quite sure why. He'd played the miller's game many times, and it seemed worth more than 2 metal discs, however shiny they might be.
"I brought a lot more than 2 suns' worth," Regan said, nodding at the coins and then looking toward the bag.
Rusko smiled.
"Not to worry," he said, untying the bag fully. As the cloth flattened on the counter, more bright coins spilled out, along with chains and rings and ropes of glittering stones. It was all very pretty, Arlen supposed,
But he was surprised at how Reagan's eyes bulged and took on a covetous glitter. Again they haggled, Reagan holding the stones up to the light and biting the coins, while Rusko fingered the cloth and tasted the spices. It was a blur to Arlen, whose head was spinning from the ale. Mug after mug came to the men from Catron at the bar, but they showed no signs of being as affected as Arlen.
220 gold suns, 2 silver moons, the rope chain, and 3 silver rings, Rusko said at last. And not a copper light more.
No wonder you work out in a backwater, Reagan said. They must have run you out of the city for a cheat.
Insults won't make you any richer,
Hogg said, confident he had the upper hand.
No riches for me this time, Reagan said. After my traveling costs, every last light will go to Greg's widow.
Ah, Jenya, Rusko said wistfully.
She used to pen for some of those in Milne with no letters, my idiot nephew among them.
What will become of her?
Reagan shook his head.
The guild paid no death price to her because Greg died at home, he said. And since she isn't a mother, a lot of jobs will be denied her.
I'm sorry to hear that, Rusko said.
Greg left her some money, Reagan said, though he never had much, and the guild will still pay her to pen. With the money from this trip, she should have enough to get by for a time. She's young, though, and it will run out eventually unless she remarries or finds better work.
And then?
Rusko asked.
Reagan shrugged.
It'll be hard for her to find a new husband, having already married and failed to bear children, but she won't become a beggar. My guild brothers and I have sworn that. One of us will take her in as a servant before that happens.
Rusko shook his head.
Still, to fall from merchant class to servant.
He reached into the much lighter bag and produced a ring with a clear, sparkling stone set into it.
See that she gets this, he said, holding the ring out.
As Reagan reached for it, though, Rusko pulled it back suddenly.
I'll have a message back from her, you understand, he said. I know how she shapes her letters.
Reagan looked at him a moment, and he quickly added, No insult meant. Reagan smiled. Your generosity outweighs your insult, he said, taking the ring. This will keep her belly full for months.
Yes, well,
Rusko said gruffly, scooping up the remains of the bag.
Don't let any of the townies hear, or I'll lose my reputation as a cheat.
Your secret is safe with me, Reagan said with a laugh.
You could earn her a bit more, perhaps, Rusko said.
Oh?
The letters we have were meant to go to Milne 6 months ago. You stick around a few days while we pen and collect more, and maybe help pen a few, and I'll compensate you. No more gold, he clarified. But surely Jenya could do with a cask of rice or some cured fish or meal.
Indeed she could, Reagan said.
I can find work for your jongleur, too, Rusko added. You'll see more custom here in the square than by hopping from farm to farm.
Agreed, Reagan said. Kieran will need gold, though. Rusko gave him a wry look, and Reagan laughed. I had to try, you understand, he said. Silver, then.
Rusko nodded.
I'll charge a moon for every performance, and for every moon I'll keep 1 star and he the other 3.
I thought you said the townies had no money, Reagan noted.
Most don't, Rusko said. I'll sell the moons to them, say at the cost of 5 credits.
So Rusko Hogg skims from both sides of the deal, Reagan asked. Hogg smiled. Arlen was excited during the ride back. Old Hogg had promised to let him see the jongleur for free if he spread the word that Kieran would be entertaining in the square at high sun the next day for 5 credits or a silver Milanese moon. He wouldn't have much time. His parents would be readying to leave just as he and Reagan returned, but he was sure he could spread the word before they pulled him out of the cart.
"Tell me about the free cities," Arlen begged as they rode. "How many have you seen?" 5, Reagan said. Milne, Angiers, Lacton, Risen, and Crasia. There may be others beyond the mountains or the desert.